Okay, there are a stream of people still coming in, but I guess let's go ahead and get started. Hi, my name is Jeff Arnold. I'm going to be talking today about K-Splice, which is a system for rebootless kernel updates. As we go throughout the talk today, I encourage you to stop me at any time and ask questions. Just, you know, raise your hand, shout out, anything. There's plenty of time allocated for questions. Yes? You can't hear me. All right, well, I'll shout louder then. Can you hear me now? Yes, kind of? All right, well, I'll shout even louder then. Okay, I'm going to be talking today about K-Splice, which is a system for rebootless kernel updates. Have I deafened the front row now? I encourage you to at any time stop me and ask questions. There's plenty of time allocated for questions in today's talk, so just at any time, shout out. Okay? I'm going to stop it a few times for questions, but really just ask at any time. Yes? The microphone is in fact on. I think the microphone... I think it's mostly for the camera. Does that help? All right, fine. I'll suck on the edge of the microphone. Okay, so yes, anytime, ask questions. I think we're ready to get started. All right, so what is K-Splice? Primarily, it's a system for fixing bugs in the Linux kernel. I hope that I'm not going to shatter anyone's worldview with this, but as great as the Linux kernel is, no, there's too many kernel hackers in the room, as transcendent as the Linux kernel is, there are occasionally some bugs that are discovered in it that you'd really rather have fixed. And so K-Splice is a system for fixing those bugs with as little disruption as possible to make you hate your life the least, basically. So the idea is that, you know, K-Splice is going to take your running kernel with the bug and turn it into a running kernel without the bug. And it's going to do so while disrupting you as little as possible. And it's going to do this by using a source code patch produced by those brilliant and witty upstream kernel developers who I can't say enough good things about, particularly since I want this code merged into mainline eventually. We're going to use basically their patches as much as possible in order to perform this change. Since those bugs are already being fixed by them, they're going to a great deal of work. Let's fix those on people's running machines without the disruption. So why do you care? Well, that's easy, because the K-Splice lets you have your cake and eat it too, and cake is delicious. I suppose since this is a technical conference, I should go into a bit more detail than that. Specifically, it lets you upgrade promptly and avoid reboots, which normally is something you have to choose between these two different things. Currently, every system administrator in the world needs to choose between whether they want to keep their machines totally up to date or whether they want to avoid the burden of reboots. And this puts them in an uncomfortable situation because either they need to be running known buggy software that's quite possibly horribly insecure, or they need to be routinely, even perhaps on a weekly basis or more, updating their kernels to the very latest release that has all of these disclosed vulnerabilities fixed. Okay? I have everyone with me. So people, can you hear me in the back still? Okay, good. All right. So what ends up happening? Well, most administrators end up throwing any semblance of security out the window, laziness prevails, and machines are rebooted relatively infrequently. It's the thing that makes sense to do because rebooting is a pain. Specifically, you know, there's downtime associated with reboots. That's kind of obvious. You know, it can only be a couple minutes for a machine, which seems kind of trivial, but if you have hundreds of machines, this means you often have to schedule a window like at 2 a.m. and come in the middle of the night and deal with rebooting all of these machines. And that, you know, is a costly for companies as well. You also lose software state, which can be annoying. You know, people lose their SSH sessions. They'll lose TCP connection state, open applications. And reboots can cause unexpected problems. My favorite example of this is a nuclear reactor that within the last year had a 48-hour shutdown because of a Windows machine that took some security updates. Now, this is something that's completely outside of the design of that system. There's no way that a Windows machine taking security updates should have been able to cause a nuclear reactor to shut down. But, you know, the logging data produced by that machine was fed into some other system, and that other system ended up panicking when this logging data suddenly disappeared for a few minutes, and it, you know, triggered a safety system and shut down the reactor. And so quite often, when people end up doing reboots on a bunch of servers, something unexpected will happen, it'll eat up a bunch of time. So, you know, they don't want to reboot, and they don't get the advantages of upgrading promptly. This is the number of bug fix commits that go into the Linux kernel stable tree every month. These are presumably problems, according to kind of the standards for what goes into the stable trees, things that users could potentially end up caring about. Most of these are not things that you would really urgently care about, but occasionally some of them are. There's usually on average about one new privilege escalation CVE every month. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, any user on the system or potentially even a remote user could use in order to gain arbitrary execution within the kernel on your system, and even systems like SE Linux aren't going to necessarily be able to protect you against that, because once they've achieved arbitrary execution in the kernel, they really can do whatever they want, even if root is restricted. Yet the exploits that are out there are basically all exploiting known vulnerabilities that the folks on the LKML have brilliantly fixed weeks ago. It usually takes quite some time for exploits to come out. And so what this really ends up meaning is that if you really, really want to be secure, particularly on a machine where malicious people have login access, but even on other machines if you want to be really secure, you need to be updating within hours to days. Days to weeks is too long. The Debian project has had two high-profile security incidents in its history, once in 2003 and once in 2006. And both of those, the kernel problems that were being exploited had been fixed long before on the LKML. There were patches that were available. One case it was like 2 months, and the other case it was over a week. But the fixes weren't applied because it can end up being a pain to do so. And so I think that it's really important for the future of security to be able to apply these updates really effectively on people's machines while causing as little trouble as possible. All right, so that's kind of the motivation section of the talk. Any questions on like the motivation and kind of why I think this is important? All right, let's proceed. All right, so what does KSPOS let you do? Well, I said before that most of the time you can feed it a patch just from the upstream kernel developers. And in fact, so of all of the non-denial of service, so kind of worse than denial of service vulnerabilities from 2005 to 2008, or actually this is known vulnerabilities that have been assigned a number by this MITRE CVE project, which is a pretty good list because most of the vendors, all of them basically, register stuff with them when they're aware of stuff. Of all of those vulnerabilities, 88% can be fixed using K-Splice without making any changes at all to the upstream patch. You tape the upstream patch, you feed it into K-Splice, it produces this magical bootless update thing that can then be sent out by a distribution, applied to your machine, fix the problem without any program or effort at all happening. 100% over this three-year interval can be fixed if a programmer goes to some amount of moderate effort to repair that other 12%. It ends up being like 12 lines of code per patch for that remaining 12%. So it's something that would be totally imaginable that one person in the world goes to this effort so that no one has to reboot their machines to take security updates. All right, so what are some of the features of K-Splice? It works with any kernel since 2.6.8. It requires no advanced perforation. You can use this on any system out there that's currently booted, that's been booted for 3 years, that's running. We could probably make it with versions older, work with versions older than 2.6.8, but that's pretty old. We kind of stopped there. The no advanced perforation is that you don't have to specially compile your kernel. You don't have to enable options. This doesn't need to be in mainline. You can really just take this user space program as root and use it on your system without any advanced perforation at all. And it works completely perfectly with modules and assembly code. It knows nothing about the semantics of like the C language or assembly. It does everything at the object code layer. So it works fine patching like the x86-64 entry path when there's a vulnerability in that a little while ago. And there's negligible performance impact. If anyone thinks they see any performance impact at any point in the talk, try to call me on it because there really isn't any, if we should get that cleared up. All right, so what's its status? The initial release was in April 2008. It's released under the GPLv2. It's been at production use at MIT since last February to keep a few kind of important servers there up, an SSH server that basically everyone uses that has several hundred concurrent users at a time, and kind of the dynamic content hosting infrastructure, web infrastructure for MIT also has been using it to stay up and up to date. The tools for creating these updates are in Debian Sid, Ubuntu, Jaunty, Fedora 8 through 10. None of these distros are actually producing the updates themselves and distributing them to people, but the tools are available. In the long term, of course, I don't see people actually using those tools themselves for these updates. It'll be produced by the distros, but we'll get to that later. We're very interested in working closely with the mainline kernel developers. We've proposed the code for mainline. I think it's the case that people are very cautious about taking it's a 10,000 line user space, 3,000 line kernel system. I think they're very cautious about committing to maintain that into the future. And so I wouldn't expect it to see it in mainline in the immediate future. But we're certainly willing to go to the work to work with people to get it in there as soon as there's interest on that side. And there's currently 4 engineers in Boston working on K-Splice full-time. If you run into a bug, you can email us. We're very good about addressing things. The code is at this point pretty stable, and there's some interesting new development going on that I'll talk about later. All right, this is kind of the plan for the rest of the talk. Now I'm going to do a little section on using K-Splice, then I'm going to go into the technical details about how it works. I'll describe kind of in more detail what patches require in new code. I'll talk about some of the other uses of K-Splice, which specifically includes debugging and instrumentation, which it actually can be really cool for. And then I'll talk about some of our future plans. Any questions on anything so far? Yes?
What sort of impact is there from possible impact is there from case bias not working?
So, I mean, any time that there's a potentially a bug in the kernel, and that could be either from the upstream Linux kernel developers or from some problem in K-Splice, really bad things can happen. But the idea is that just like the upstream kernel developers work really hard in order to make that code be totally perfect, we've worked really hard to make this code be totally perfect. And so, I mean, it's kernel code, so yes, you know, things can go horribly wrong. But, I mean, just like, I mean, worst case with anything in the kernel is all of your data's gone because it's the kernel and, you know, but the practical worst case is probably that it, like, freezes your machine. Yeah. Even that, probably an oops is much more likely and the machine keeps running fine. But all of that, we don't see that kind of thing these days because the code is too stable. Okay, any other questions? Alright, so let's talk a little bit now about kind of what I see the end user experience being. So you see here I'm running Ubuntu, this is the latest Ubuntu kernel. The idea is that just like your normal package manager notifies you that you have user space updates, your kernel update manager should notify you that you have kernel updates, and that the kernel that you're running, the latest Ubuntu kernel, has got a bunch of vulnerabilities in it and other problems that have since been committed to the Linux stable tree and they're not fixed on my machine. And so the idea is that I should just be able to click a button, install all updates, and have it go through and indeed patch my kernel to apply all these things. And so when I click install all updates, there's going to be a progress bar that appears, and each time the progress bar moves, it's applying a kernel update to my machine, fixing some problem in the kernel. So this right here is Libertas fix buffer overrun. We can see here, that this is committed by a particular person, the stuff that it does. There's the actual patch that we're basically going to be applying to our machine. And let's go ahead and click install updates, and off we go. It's applying a bunch of kernel updates. Every time the progress bar moves, it's doing a safety check and the process that I'll basically be talking about later for how K-Splice works. And when it's done, it's going to tell us that all of the updates are installed, I'm A-OK, my kernel is up to date. So that's kind of the end user experience that we're going for. Thank you. At the moment, there's no distros that support doing this. I'll talk later about how we're going to get from kind of here to there. Okay. So let's talk. Yes.
Sorry, if you're doing that, and say you've got the Fedora standard kernel, they apply their own patches. If you install all the stuff that's in the mainline kernel, and they happen to give you a new kernel that doesn't have some of those patches, that'll override that. So.
Right, so if you're actually doing this with a real distro like Fedora, the plan would probably be that when Fedora releases a new kernel at the same time, they've done Q&A for that kernel, at the same time you release basically that set of updates in rebootless form, and you get them as rebootless updates, and then if you reboot into the new Fedora kernel, you can either configure your machine to reboot into the new Fedora kernel when you reboot and you get their regular kernel, or you can have it apply the rebootless updates to the existing kernel over again. But basically, there's no reason that you need to start running a different version than the upstream Fedora kernel. You can always just basically apply all of the patches they've applied in rebootless form. Does that make sense? Yes. Yes, you can reverse patches too. I'll show that later. Yes. Right. So 88% of the security patches can be applied. Just you take the patch, you feed it into the system, everything's automatic. We can do 100% in the last 3 years with a little bit of programmer effort. And it's possible that at some point in the future something will come along that's so nasty to do as a rebootless update that it makes us really hate our lives. But we haven't encountered that yet. Something that requires an extension to what? I'll talk later about how you can add fields to structs and do some of the more complicated things. Okay? Any other questions? All right, let's keep, okay. So here's an example of a patch that we might want to apply. This is kind of a famous vulnerability, CVE-2008-0600. This is the splice vulnerability that there was exploits code circulating for. The basic idea here is that this line is wrong, that there's some stuff coming from user space of base and a len that's not being checked to see if it's appropriate, these values that have been passed from user space. And if we don't check that they're appropriate and the user passes in values that are inappropriate, they can be clever and break into your kernel. And so this is, an example of the kind of patch that K-Splice handles quite well. Let's talk now about I've demoed the kind of end user experience and shown, the kind of patch that K-Splice can apply. Let's talk now a little bit about how K-Splice kind of works internally a little bit so that you can get some perspective on kind of what it's doing and how the distros would go about preparing these or we would go about preparing these for use. So kind of these are the inputs to K-Splice, the pre-source and the post-source. And these terms are going to be really important for the rest of the talk, so you should pay attention to, you know, this slide, if nothing else. So the pre-source code is the source code for your running kernel. It's the pre-patch source code, which is why it's the pre-source. And whenever you see the term pre in something for the rest of the talk, it refers to something having to do with basically the kernel source before the patch was applied. The post-source is the source code for the kernel after the patch has been applied. Okay, so that's the patch that you're wanting to apply to your running kernel. Okay, and this is kind of one way of describing the inputs. You can imagine the way that people often use it is that you pass it a directory that contains the source code for your running kernel, and you pass it a patch file, like, you know, this patch file in, you know, unified diff format, and then K-Splice can from that, you know, have basically the pre-patch, the pre-source, and the post-source. Does that make sense? Any questions here? Yes. That's right. And actually, none of those builds were occurring on my laptop. Like when I did that demo, I'm pulling binary updates from, you know, a central server. But that's right. Yep. Any other questions? Yes. Right. So the approach that we currently favor for doing this is that when you reboot, you end up getting the original kernel that you booted the first time, and then, like, before it brings up the network interfaces, it loads all of the updates. People tend to prefer that because that way all of their systems, regardless of whether or not they've rebooted, are really in kind of the most similar state. Right. Well, applying the updates doesn't actually take all that long. This actually, the demo there is actually a bit slow because of the user space stuff. I kind of want to throw things at the person who wrote that code. It's like YAML stuff that's currently slowing it down. We'll see whether or not, we have yet to determine whether or not, once we've, like, deployed hundreds or thousands of these updates, whether we need to do something a bit different than that plan for desktop boot time. I suspect that we can just make patch application fast enough that it's not an issue. Yes. Yeah. Right. You probably don't ever. This is one thing you might be talking about. You probably don't want to go from 2.6.28 to 2.6.29 using K-Splice. You're just going to basically be following, like, the stable tree or a subset of the stable tree that's, like, the important stable tree commits. So, like, going from 2.6.28.1 to 2.6.28.4. Okay. Any other questions on this? We do have plenty of time for questions, so.
So the practical for a distro, in practical applications, it's pretty much a distro updating the distro kernel for a release, by a single release.
Yeah, basically. And you can imagine that if a distro wants to move to a completely new kernel release, that they then actually do require that people reboot, but it would be much less often. It would be every few months to go from 2.6.28 to 2.6.29 because there's some really important feature in 2.6.29 that they want everyone to have. Yeah. Yeah, it's the reboots happening so frequently that you can't keep your system totally up to date. Sure. I wouldn't want to deal with rebooting every night, but sure. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Yep. And if a distro wanted to maintain a single kernel for a very long time without having you ever reboot, that would certainly be possible. Because distros do sometimes, like Red Hat Enterprise Linux, will stay on 2.6.16 forever. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yeah. I mean, both are very easy. Any particular deployment of this might give the option or might not. We haven't figured that out yet. Yes. Yes, that's correct. There's a little bit of reordering that can be done, but mostly order does matter. Yeah. Other questions? Are we ready to move on? All right. All right, so this is an example of like running case plus create, which is the command for creating a update. This is, you know, the form I talked about. There is the source directory that contains the pre-source. There's the patch that is the patch we want to apply to the running machine. That's like a file in that directory. Case plus then creates a case plus update file, which is basically a tarball. It contains some kernel modules and some other stuff. It contains a unique ID, which I've shortened here to be 3 characters. Normally the unique ID is like 8 characters. Then, you know, become the super user and can apply the case plus update as root. Obviously, if a distro is, you know, distributing this stuff, they use a fancy GUI or some other command line utilities that are a bit fancier than these. We have command line utilities that are fancier than these for, you know, just bringing a machine totally up to date by pulling some updates over the network. But this is kind of the lowest level, you know, case plus plumbing, so to speak. Okay, so I wanted to give another kind of case-place demo of kind of the case-place command line utilities in action. And so the inspiration I decided to use this is Wikipedia, since I knew there was going to be a Wikipedia talk in the morning of this talk. And so this is the Wikipedia article on uptime, and it says long uptime can indicate negligence because critical updates can sometimes require reboots. And this kind of irritates me. This is, you know, I hope now obsolete eventually. And so what I'm going to do is show you an example of Caseplace's kind of Git integration and changing the running kernel so that it displays a different uptime, a much larger uptime, kind of in defiance to the Wikipedia uptime article. So the way that, you know, when we run the uptime program, I have to kind of hold the mic and type with one hand, you know, it prints out the uptime this machine has been up. It's been up for 1 hour and 2 minutes so far, okay? The way that that works is that there's a proc node, proc uptime, that, you know, when you cat it, you know, prints out, oh, I should increase my font. Cat proc uptime, you know, prints out some values there that it's using in order to have in order for the user space utility to, you know, say that it's 1 hour and 2 minutes. All right, so here I have a Linux kernel source directory. That's the source code for my running Ubuntu kernel. This is directly cloned, basically, from the upstream Ubuntu sources. And what I'm going to do is go and make a change to the source code that will it'll make sense when I start doing it. Okay, so let's open up the file that's responsible for that proc file. Okay, so here's the function uptime read proc, and we can see here where it's doing this printf of these two different values in order to print why, you know, catted proc uptime, it printed, you know, these two numbers. And so what we can just go ahead and do here is add in a line that adds some time to our uptime.
Nanoseconds per second times the number of seconds in a day times 100 days. No, let's make it 1,000 days. All right, so that line looks good now. Let's just go ahead and save that and commit that file. Increase my uptime. Wikipedia is wrong.
All right, so we've now made that Git commit. We can go ahead and show it.
All right, there it is. It adds some stuff to our uptime.
Some of us actually compile it before we commit it. You've got
All right, so I previously have told Caseplace one thing, which I told it that, you know, I told it basically, hey, this is the source code for my starting kernel, and it then did a build of my starting kernel to remember kind of the pre-object files for my running kernel, the pre-remember being the pre-source code. Pre-patch stuff. Now I'm going to run caseplus create git equals head, so it's going to now create caseplus updates for all of the commits since the previous time I ran caseplus with the, you know, initialize option. So, oh, can I move up the screen? Yeah, sure. Is that better? All right, so I'm running caseplus create hyphen hyphen git equals head. There's only one commit, basically, between the kernel I'm running and head, so it's just going to create one update. Let's go ahead and fire that off. So what caseplus is doing now, I'm going to talk about this more in detail later, is it's doing a kernel build now, and it's going to be comparing the object files of the original kernel build to the object files of this build. We saw it just compiled proc misc. It's going to be comparing those object files, figuring out what's functions changed, and now, it's created an update for us. It's now caseplace-wf some stuff. Let's go ahead and apply that. So we're going to run sudo, I'll put down the mic.
Sudo caseplace apply that update. And now when we cat proc uptime.
Our uptime is huge. Okay. And of course, if we want to, we can undo that update. We just run case splice undo followed by the case splice ID. Case splice view shows us all of the case splice updates that installed.
I've got a bunch of updates installed actually right now.
We can see, you know, the update IDs and their descriptions. This is the one here that I just installed. I didn't specify an update on the command line, a description on the command line when I created it.
Sudo case splice undo.
And now we're back to, you know, 1 hour. Okay, so that's KSC case splice in operation. All right, so now let's talk about what this is doing. Any questions so far on any stuff we've done? Okay, so this is a running kernel, and it contains, you know, two functions, foo and bar, okay? And of course, the running kernel, you know, it's executable object code. This isn't source code in the running kernel. It's, you know, executable code that the processor can run. And here's the basic game plan. We're going to load a module that's going to contain a new version of the function foo. This is going to be a version of foo that corresponds to the post source, okay? And it's going to obviously be compiled, and it needs to be all ready to basically go as executable code in the kernel, which means that any kernel data structures that this function foo uses, this function foo needs to already, like, basically be accessing those kernel data structures. It needs to be all set up for that. And what we're going to do is insert a jump instruction at the beginning of the old foo to the start of the new foo. And once we've and we're going to have to do that in an appropriate time. And once we've inserted that jump instruction, now whenever the function foo gets called, it's going to go and run the new version. Okay? So the basic plan is kind of simple. The tricky parts here is that, well, this new version of foo needs to look just right for corresponding to the post version we're interested in. This new version of foo needs to correctly refer to all of the kernel's existing data structures and functions, which is a little bit tricky, as it turns out. And we need to find an appropriate time for sticking in this jump instruction so that we don't, for example, end up with the old version of foo running at the same time as the new version of foo, which could be disastrous if, like, the locking semantics of foo have changed. If now it uses a different mechanism for controlling access to some shared resource, they could both stop on that resource. Okay, any questions about the basic plan? Okay. So this is the summary of kind of this tricky stuff that we need to do. I mostly said that. All right, so here's how case splice is going to work. There's going to be two phases. First, we're going to build the update. That occurs mostly in user space. Then we're going to apply the update. That occurs mostly in kernel space, or entirely in kernel space. Entirely in user space, entirely in kernel space. Building the update is going to consist of finding out what changed, and it's going to consist of preparing both this thing that we call the pre-code and the post-code. So it was previously I defined the pre-source and the post-source. The pre-code and the post-code are kind of things that are based on the pre-source and the post-source respectively. There's some processing that's occurred, and I'm going to describe that on the next slide. Applying the update consists of matching the pre-code to the running kernel. Now, what the hell does that mean? So it kind of makes sense to be comparing the pre-code to the running kernel, because the pre-code is based on the pre-source, the pre-patch source, and the pre-patch source is supposedly the source code corresponding to the running kernel. And so we're doing some kind of comparison here, I guess, between the you know, pre-source code that's now been compiled and processed in some way to the running kernel. And this is going to give us several useful pieces of information that I'm going to talk about more later. But you should just be aware that there's this comparison between something based on the pre-source and the running kernel. And at a safe time, we're going to make the kernel start using the post-code. Okay, any questions on this basic hand-wavy plan? I'm kind of introing the whole thing before I go into detail. All right. So let's look at building an update. So we start off with the pre-source and the post-source. Then we're going to basically compile them using GCC, and we get what I call, you know, the compiled pre and the compiled post. And then we're going to find out what differs at that stage at the object code layer. We're comparing the machine code for the compiled pre and the compiled post to figure out what functions changed. Then we're going to do a little bit of manipulation at the ELF layer, which is, you know, the object code standard, basically, using this library called libbfd, which is an ELF code, an ELF manipulation library, basically, by the GNU project. And we're going to use that to produce this thing that I called the pre-code and the post-code, okay? So basically, we start off with the pre-source and the post-source, we compile them, we then do that comparison using the object code, we modify the object code a little bit, and then we get these things that we're going to end up using when we apply the update. These are the two things that we use when applying the update and that are useful. And I've been very hand-wavy about this stage, which is why I'm going to explain that more in the next slide. Any questions on the plan so far? Okay. So this is like a sample C program that maybe this is our post code, for example. We have an extern int x and an int y equals 3, and we have a function foo that does some stuff with x and y. And normally when we, okay, so an extern in C, I'll mention this quickly, is a way of saying basically the variable x isn't defined in this C file, it's defined in some other C file, some other compilation unit, and the linker later will make x in the object code point to the right place. So when we compile this, what's going to happen is the compiler is going to set aside some space for y, it's going to initialize that value to 3, and then it's going to make the object code for foo. The x is going to be an unresolved symbol because we don't know where that exists yet, and y is going to kind of point to this internal 3 within the object file. Okay? People with me so far? Any questions? All right. So this is inappropriate for case splice because when we produce an update, we're not interested in loading a new version of this integer y equals 3. We want to use whatever y is already in the kernel because we don't want to, the kernel already has some value of y that's quite possibly no longer 3. It's probably 8 by now or something totally different. And so we're not interested in loading a new version of y and forcing the kernel to start using it in this function and use the old version of y in the other code that we're not updating. We need to make sure that this y in this code that we're updating points to the y that's already in the kernel. Okay? And so one of the things that case-splice is going to have to do, and this is the elf manipulation I was talking about earlier, is basically make all of the symbols be unresolved at this stage, and then we'll deal with correctly, sewing them into the pointing them at the correct places in the kernel, the x and y that are already in the kernel at a later stage of the application process. Does that make sense? Any questions of this? Yes. If it's completely new, it will indeed load a version of it. If it's old, it will do this stuff. That's right. Yes.
So only work if you have a
real
for y?
If you have a what for y? So he's wondering if it only works if you have a relocation record for y. And the answer is that there are ways that you can force there to be relocation entries for all of the data structures, basically. Specifically, fdata sections is a compiler option that does this. Ffunction sections is the equivalent for functions. And so case-splice has to be a little clever there to force there to be these relocation records. Yes? Right. Okay. So I'm going to get to that later. That's that 12th. It is the case that a human has to review these patches and decide whether they're the 88% that can be applied automatically or the 12% that requires some extra work. And an example of where if you're completely changing the semantics of y so that it has some completely different meaning than it used to, that's that 12% where you have to figure out, a human has to figure out what the hell to do. And that is, in fact, one of the sources here of error. But the idea is that because so much can be done completely automatically, that there's relatively little humans doing, hopefully they're not going to screw up. Yes?
Do you manage to cope with architectures like PowerPC where you have a base register that's different to the main kernel for different modules?
Right, so we currently support x86-32, x86-64, and ARM. I don't imagine having any major problems making things work on PowerPC, but I haven't looked at it in detail. We can talk offline about that if you want to go into the detail of how I would imagine fixing any issues you think there are. Other questions? Yes?
I'm not very good with the kernel, so maybe you can just say, go and read some documentation. That would be an acceptable answer. But as far as I understand, it's easy to exchange modules. Now, let's assume you have some sort of kernel thread that runs in a loop. You can actually, using this, because of the jump location, it'll just, in the next iteration, it'll go to the new code. You don't actually have to reload anything. It'll just do that magically.
I don't quite follow. Maybe it would be best if we talk after the talk and we can work it out. If someone else did understand and wants to repeat the question.
I think you're going to cover it.
OK. All right. Sounds good. All right. So summary building an update. The update contains the pre-code, which is a modified version of the compiled pre-source, the post-code, which is a modified version of the compiled post-source, a list of functions that changed, and the major modification that we're talking about there is that all the symbols have been made unresolved. OK, that's the summary of building an update. All right, let's talk about applying an update. So there's this phase I talked about before of matching the pre-code to the running kernel. And this buys us two things. The first thing that it buys us is it's a nice safety check that we're applying this update to the kernel that it was intended for, that the user didn't screw up and feed, you know, completely the wrong source code from what corresponds to the running kernel. It also is a way of making sure that, like, the running kernel code hasn't already been trampled on by some, like, one-time code modification system that's been added to the kernel that we're not aware of. It's a nice safety check for several reasons. I can go into that with more detail offline if you're interested. So this is really one of the kind of more cool parts, is you can use this to discover all of the symbol values that we need for pointing X and Y to the correct places. So that was one of the challenges we created for ourselves in the last step, was that X and Y are now totally unresolved symbols. We need to figure out where they point into the running kernel. As it turns out, the kernel symbol tables, and really no symbol tables, are sufficient for determining where we need to point everything, because there can be multiple symbols with the same name, and there's no way that you can determine which symbol, which static int x inside of a function that appears in your symbol table is the correct static int x for, you know, this usage. And this also allows, this is one of the things that allows KSplice to work on any kernel that's out there, and they can figure out everything that it needs to from the running kernel just by comparing that pre-code to the running kernel. And there's another slide on that in a second if you're still unclear. All right, so the next phase of applying an update is we're going to use this Linux functionality called stop machine in order to capture all of the CPUs on the system momentarily and then run some code on one of those CPUs. And when we have the machine kind of stopped momentarily, we're going to perform a safe time check to make sure that this is a safe time to insert the jump instructions. We're going to insert the jump instructions, and this entire stop machine phase only takes about 0.7 milliseconds or 700 microseconds. That's the amount of time that the machine is actually running KSplice code not available to run other code on the system, but 0.7 milliseconds or 700 microseconds is so small that almost all applications don't care about the system being momentarily unavailable for that length of time. Even, you know, it does depend on how many processors you've got. I'd imagine that if you're doing this on a 1,000 processor machine, it could be an issue, but stop machine is used for other stuff, and yeah. There are potentially cleverer ways than using stop machine. Our approach is very much, let's get the simple approach now, and later we can do something fancier if we need to. Other questions? Matching the pre-code to the running kernel. So what this is going to be is actually basically a byte-by-byte comparison. Remember I said that KSplice isn't aware of the semantics of, like, C or assembly, so it's mostly just doing a byte-by-byte comparison. It actually knows opcode lengths, and that's about it, by using the version we're proposing for merge doesn't even require knowing opcode lengths. Okay, and the deal is that when the obsolete code refers to a symbol, we're going to discover what value that symbol should have based on the running kernel, because we have our function int foo in the running kernel's code, we have our function int foo in the pre-code, we know that a certain length into that function, there's a reference to the variable x, the running kernel already refers to x at that location, we can compute the value of the symbol x just right there from the running kernel. And these discovered symbol values can be used to resolve symbols in the post code to produce the final code that we're going to end up running on the system. And we have to be aware of systems for modifying the running kernel code, like ALT instructions that the kernel uses or para instructions. The safe time check, I mentioned this before, it's used to ensure that the switchover to the new version is atomic, like so that if the locking semantics changed, you don't run into trouble. For every thread, it checks that the thread is not in the middle of executing any replaced function. So what we're going to do is make sure that, like, if we're replacing the function foo, that no thread on the system is in the middle of executing foo. That could either mean that its instruction pointer is in the middle of executing foo, or that foo is basically on its kernel stack. And if necessary, we can abort and try again. As it turns out, you don't often need to abort and try again. You don't often need to completely abort. It's possible that if you're patching a function that's basically in continuous use by the system, that's so-called non-quiescent, that KSplice can't be used to patch it. We have not encountered that case so far with any of the 3 years worth of security updates, and there's also fancier stuff we can do to avoid this in the future if it becomes an issue. Okay, sorry about that. No. We check every value on the kernel stack. We don't wrap the ESP. Okay. So what kind of patches require new code. So the fundamental thing here is that, as I've described, K-Splice basically is changing the code on the system. It's not going and like magically figuring out that, oh, currently int y in the kernel is 7. We now need that value to be 18 because of this source code patch. It's only transforming the kernel code. It's not transforming the kernel state. And K-Splice does not do automatic transformations to the kernel state, which means that if you're changing the semantics of the kernel state in the ways I'll describe here, for example, so the question you need to be asking yourself for whether K-Splice can safely apply a patch is, does this patch require changes to the kernel's internal state in order for this patch to be valid? So for example, if you add a field to a struct, it's obviously the case that you're going to need to know what that field value should have, that field should have for all existing instances of that structure in the kernel. So there's already a bunch of that struct probably allocated all over the kernel. We need to know what value that field should have for all of those existing allocated instances, and K-Splice has no way of defining what that should be. A programmer's going to have to write code to compute meaningful, you know, initial values there. Similarly, if you change how the data structure is initialized, K-Splice has no way of magically knowing like how that change could potentially have propagated throughout the system. But as it turns out, it's usually fairly easy for a programmer to do the right thing. I've got a slide on that later. So here's like the long list of CVEs that don't require any new code. Here's the CVEs that do require new code. The number of logical lines of new code that are required, it's not too many. So what does this new code do? The most common thing is that it walks existing data structure instances, updating them. And when adding a new field to a struct, it needs to initialize that field for existing instances. What code does the new form take? Well, I don't have to like learn some special K-Splice, you know, patching language or anything like that. You just simply modify the original source code patch, basically adding code to it to do the appropriate thing. And you can use macros provided by K-Splice in a header that you include in order to run the code when the update's applied. So like K-Splice pre-apply will run the func when the update is applied before stop machine is called. This is, you know, called during stop machine, and there's a whole bunch of others. Okay, so here's a real example. Got 5 minutes. All right. So this is an example of a patch that K-Splice can't handle because initialization time, you can see it's even very blatantly initialization time because it's __init init AMD. If the CPU, you know, revision number is greater than this, set this bit in this structure, and there's some other changes too. But the idea is that K-Splice isn't going to automatically be able to, you know, realize that it needs to set this bit at, you know, that should have occurred in initialization time, but that obviously didn't occur in initialization time on your system. So a programmer, I've made these lines blue. You can see it's basically an if statement and this set bit. The code that a programmer needs to write is this code. They basically just add this code into the patch. Include K-Splice patch.h, they make a little function, that function loops over all the CPUs, gets the CPU pointer, does a little if statement, basically if the CPU ID is greater than that number and is an AMD CPU, then, you know, set this bit. And that's all you need to do. And it usually ends up being fairly simple like this, basically walking a data structure and doing some update to, you know, be in the, and the reason that this bit is set is so that later it can be checked to do the security appropriate thing, you know, in some other function in the kernel. That was a little fast, but any questions? Okay. Yes, this is the next slide. So, adding fields to structs. So the problem that you just described is, in fact, this one. So the old layout there, all of the A's appear right next to each other. In the new layout, you know, when you add the field B, you're expecting there to be B's all over the place, like this, right? And so how the hell does K-Splice get from one to the other? And the answer is that it doesn't. So this is an idea that's been around in research papers for a while. So what we want to do is we're going to have a shadow field off to the side. And the idea is we're going to basically end up keeping this old layout for these A's, and we're going to record the B values off to the side. And we're going to figure out what the B value is corresponding to one of these A's by just basically taking the address of this A instance, hashing it, and then looking up in a hash table, basically, the corresponding B. And so this is a nice way of getting an order one time from an A instance to its corresponding B without having to go and modify these existing data structures. And since we're providing all of the code that's going to be ever accessing B, because B was a new field that's just being introduced, we can have that new code do this special lookup off to the side for B's rather than looking for the B's in, you know, right after the A's. Okay? So the shadow fields are off the side. The LWN coverage complained that we did this in order n time because we did it with a link with a linked list of values rather than a hash table. The guy who coded this up is like, you know, one of these, you know, programming competition, algorithmic programming competition guys, and he completely flipped out that he'd been called for doing an order n time thing. He flipped out. He was really, really sad because, of course, you actually want to do it in order one time, and, you know, he just didn't want to stick a hash table into the kernel for this implementation. Anyway, you know, that's the lookup you do. Alright, so let's talk quickly about debugging. I guess I have 5 minutes. I want to leave a little bit of time for questions at the end. Yep. Right, so rolling back the data structure transformer patches is more complicated. It certainly can be done, but someone needs to write the reverse transformer, which we've done for all of the ones that we've done so far. It's not that hard, because usually once you've written one way, going the other way is, yeah. All right, so let's talk about debugging. So yeah, looking inside a running system can be really invaluable. So like sometimes you'll get, like we had a server at MIT that, you know, every so often after the machine's been up for 2 weeks, CDing into a particular directory returns, you know, enon a directory for that directory. And it only happens on this machine that's under a production load. It only happens after a while. And like it would be a real pain because it's a production machine to reboot it into a new kernel that has additional instrumentation printing out stuff. And so it's really convenient if you can just go into the source code like I did earlier with Git, make some commits, add some print statements, see what's going on, and fix the problem. The nice thing here about, you know, using K-Splice rather than some other system like SystemTap or KGDB, they have their uses. They're great. I'm not meaning to criticize them at all. But the situations in which you might want to use K-Splice for debugging is that you get to really write real C code that can access any kernel function, any kernel data structure. It'll be automatically discovered using that matching process that I described earlier. You can add code to any compilation unit. You can insert code almost anywhere, including into the middle of functions. And yep. Future plans, right, so if you want something done right, do it yourself. We're going to start providing rebootless updates, the group of us up in Boston, for a community Linux distro at some point in the not-too-distant future. Realistically, it's not realistic to expect the distros to immediately take our 10,000 lines of code and commit to, you know, support it themselves. So we're going to start doing it. We don't know exactly when yet. We're also working on continuing to advance TOT updates that you can really apply almost the entire stable tree using K-Splice without anyone having to go to too much work writing these data structure transformers. This is kind of a less crazy goal than it might sound, at least I think so. Currently, you can do, you know, over half the patches kind of totally automatically, and the others, we need more clever techniques to make easy. Thanks to various people, including MIT, and if you want more information, you can get from here, and I guess I have 2 minutes for questions. Yes? Yes, most of the ideas would apply. We're not planning on doing a user space port anytime in the immediate future, but we might eventually. Yes?
He would like to know, he would like the books outputs to A, be taken, and B, list which case splices are applied.
One thing is that the oops output displays the modules that are loaded. The modules that are loaded always indicate the K-splice underscore and then the K-splice ID, you know, that unique ID for the K-splice update, and we already taint the kernel when we apply K-splice update. So, yes. Certainly, we don't foresee at any time in the future going from like 2.6.25 to 2.6.26. Going from 2.6.25x to 2.6.25x plus n is more feasible. Was there one in the back? Yeah. If I followed your question, yes. Yes.
Obviously, if you're running a kernel for a long time with lots of updates, it seems to me you'd end up losing things and you'd end up leaking kernel memory.
If you repeat the question?
If you have a long-running kernel and you're consistently updating, my understanding is you'd end up leaking kernel memory. Obviously, if they're small patches, that's not a huge amount, but
Right, so yes, it's the case that one of the performance impact the K-splice has is whenever you apply an update, the object code for the update ends up obviously getting consumed. If at some point in the future that code is no longer being used, you can imagine garbage collecting that memory. We don't currently do that because on most systems that have multi-gigabytes of memory, you know, a few kilobytes for patches isn't a big deal, but...
Okay, so you do the stop machine and then you do the check.
Yeah.
So...
Okay. One answer is so sorry. There's various places people ask about offloading to user space, and sometimes the answer is that I don't want to trust root with basically kernel privilege level, because some people, you know, require that you only load signed modules. So you've got to be very careful about what you trust user space to do. But that's probably. But what?
the question is, basically.
I should let people go, but go ahead. Sorry. Sorry.
Didn't realize we were holding you here. I'll stay there.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean,
if you want to go, go ahead.
Surely you could actually get everything pre-canned from user space if they have access to kernel memory, and then go, has it changed? If so, abort. If not, just apply the changes that user space has pre-calculated for you.
What stage specifically are you concerned about being performed in the kernel? The symbol, the symbol match, the run pre-matching, or?
Yeah, basically figuring out where you should do the relocations to based on the kernel.
Yes, I guess. But if you're not concerned about trusting root, a bunch of stuff could be offloaded to user space, and it would be pretty trivial to do so. And we could talk about doing that if, yeah. It wouldn't be faster, just the kernel people hate having stuff in the kernel. Yes. Yeah. All of this code is available for download. Case it loads all the necessary case splice code as a module at the same time that it loads the update module. Yes.
Is there any potential for problems with L1 caches having old data that could cause problems here?
No, we do all the necessary cache flushing and stuff. Yes.
If the kernel is compiled with a different version of GCC.
Yes. You want to use the same compiler and assembler to build the update, and if you don't, that safety check match will notify you that there's some funky stuff going on and will fail safe. Yes?
Work on every platform.
What do you mean, architecture? We currently support x86, 32, and 64, and ARM, and we don't foresee problems porting it to other architectures. Yes? If you have kernel bugs, you're always in trouble. Yeah, the case splice code, if it had bugs, you could be in trouble. But obviously, just like the mainstream kernel people try to be very good, we try to be very good. Other questions? What's that?
Case splice, obviously.
Yeah, that's also true. Exactly. All right. Yes? Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for coming, everyone. If you have more questions, you can catch me.